One of Utah's strengths has been the high degree of economic mobility its residents enjoy and the state's relatively low level of economic inequality. Using the standard measure known as the Gini coefficient, Utah regularly ranks at or near the top of the nation in terms of income equality. But Utah's relative equality is in the context of a nation whose measure of economic inequality resembles developing nations rather than most industrialized counterparts in Canada, Australia, and Europe. And significant divides exist within Utah, within certain jurisdictions, and along urban-rural lines. At a recent Utah Foundation breakfast briefing, we sat down with five University of Utah professors whose work touches on income inequality. You'll hear some of their thoughts in this edition of Utah Thrives, the Utah Foundation podcast. I'm Peter Reichardt. First, we will hear from Dr. Norman J. Waitzman, professor and chair of the Department of Economics. Norm?
It's very important to try to contextualize things like rising inequality, which has so many manifest dimensions to it. And we've already gotten a little sort of peg for how Utah is different. I wanted to contextualize things to indicate that we might not be as distinctive as often purported. I grew up in New Jersey, spent my early life there, and it was sort of Orwellian to have the Garden State on our license plate. Many people advocated the asphalt state. We were distinctive in that fashion. And it's often too much to say that Utah is so different from the rest of the nation. We march in lockstep from the 19 or before the 1920s, right up through the mid 2010s. This is very important because it shows that we're not totally in control of what goes on, that there's manifold forces that are occurring within the economy that's driving inequality and this incredible amassing of income and wealth in the upper reaches of the distribution. In fact, Utah in some ways beginning in the late 70s and going through the present have not done as well, if you will, in terms of this trend as the nation, where you can see that Utah is now reaching the peak of inequality within the state at historically, that is ever, relative to the United States, which yes, it's tinkering, it's lapping at the shores of that upper reach since the 1920s, but it hasn't really been there. So I wanted to just reaffirm, this doesn't mean that we don't have control and our policies don't have an effect on distribution, but we certainly are part of the country. For ourselves and several of the individual states, the growth from in 25 years, really between 90 and 14, bottom 5% saw a 10% decline. The median household saw no change in real income, and the upper 1% reveled in this 75% increase. This is not an inexorable process, by the way. We can return to this if you wanted to talk about it. This is a direct reflection, not of technological change or international trade or skilled versus unskilled jobs. This is the direct result, I would argue, of distinct policy choices, many of which have been undertaken in Utah.
Now we'll turn to Dr. Sarah Gruneski, Professor of Sociology and Environmental Studies. Sarah?
Here in Salt Lake in the last year or so, my team has published two studies that quantify inequalities and exposures to air pollution. So even within a place that has, according to our statewide statistics, a relatively lower inequality, we still have pretty dramatic differences in income at the neighborhood level. The average here in Salt Lake is $65,000. So in this study, we found that greater proportions of Hispanic, Black, and Pacific Islander residents predicted higher levels of air pollution, specifically PM2.5 and diesel particulate matter, but also air toxics known to cause cancer, as well as those known to cause respiratory problems. And these findings exist even after we account for renter status, median household income, population density, among other factors. So after completing that study, we examined a similar question in another paper looking at environmental inequalities with respect to school demographics and changing scenarios of PM2.5 pollution at 174 public schools in the central Salt Lake County region. And instead of relying on measures of chronic pollution, in this study, we looked at three scenarios that are typical of Salt Lake: a major winter inversion, a moderate winter inversion, and a relatively clean day. Across all three scenarios, we found that schools serving predominantly racial ethnic minority students were disproportionately exposed to worse PM2.5. So that's during the major inversion, the moderate inversion, as well as when the air is relatively clean. We found that charter schools and schools serving low-income students were disproportionately exposed when the PM2.5 was low or a relatively clean set of days or moderate. So putting these two papers together, the findings contribute to this idea that we have pretty serious environmental inequalities here in the Salt Lake metro area with respect to race and ethnicity. Certainly the pattern relates to economic inequalities, but it's not entirely subsumed by those inequalities.
Thank you, Sarah. Next, we'll hear from Dr. Daniel Mendoza, Research Assistant Professor of Atmospheric Sciences, Visiting Assistant Professor of City and Metropolitan Planning. Go ahead, Daniel.
Right now, we're in a crisis. We're in a pandemic, and as we're all very familiar with what is going on with COVID-19, I like to look at two metrics, which are the median per capita income and the percent white population. Positive cases per 100,000 population is almost 10 times higher for the lowest income zip code compared to the higher income zip code. So you can see that we have about 1,600 per 100,000 population versus a little bit under 200 for the lowest cases. This pattern continues where we have the percent white population, which varies between 50 to almost 93%. What we can see is that the curve was flattened for the more white and higher income zip codes, whereas the lower income zip codes, their rate really kept growing steadily. We can see why we think one of the reasons that may be caused. So let's compare two zip codes. One is 84104, which is Glendale area, and 84105, which is around the Yale Crest, right north of Sugar House area. Again, almost about three times the difference in terms of per capita income. The white population is essentially almost doubled. What's interesting is that during the stay-at-home directive, 84104, they saw a traffic drop in about 10 to 15%, whereas for 84105, saw a decrease of almost 50%.
Okay, thank you, Daniel. And now let's hear from Dr. Marshall Steinbaum, Assistant Professor of Economics. Marshall?
Hi, thank you very much for having me. I wanted to address issues of higher education inequality, especially in light of the COVID pandemic. So there's a sort of outstanding question about whether higher education is itself an egalitarian or inegalitarian force in society. On the one hand, you could think that higher education generally benefits both the children of people who are better off, and also that graduates of college tend to earn higher incomes, and therefore, as a sort of public institution, it's an inegalitarian one. On the other hand, there's a tradition of social mobility that it is the route to the middle class. So it's a complex picture overall as to sort of categorizing it in that way, but I think one thing that we can definitely say is that higher education, in particular public higher education, has become less egalitarian over time, and this is the phenomenon I wanted to focus on because I feel that that's at great risk in light of the oncoming economic crises related to the COVID pandemic. So the way that we measure how egalitarian higher education as a whole is, and then in particular specific institutions, is to look at two different things. One is the access of low SES students to particular institutions. So what share of the student body comes from backgrounds where their parents basically are well off or not well off, and then how successful are those institutions at having their students move up the income ladder. So this mobility rate is in general in decline. The starkest case here that I've reported is the University of California, Berkeley, where they have adopted, they have essentially moved from what was the California Master Plan, so essentially free tuition for anyone who could gain admission to the state university system, to one where they do charge substantial tuition. And what that has meant is a changing character of the student body that is admitted to each of these institutions. The decline is less dramatic for the other institutions. And in fact, in the case of many of them, there has been a little decline, but that's because they are starting from a relatively low level. And I can tell you that insofar as this reports a product of two numbers, the thing that's changing is the access of lower income students to state flagship universities. So the rate at which low income students attain higher status in their own professional lives, that's relatively unchanged over time. It's the decreasing number of people, of students drawn from low SES backgrounds that's in general declining among public state flagships. And this is really due to a couple of, I would say, mutually reinforcing trends, state budget cuts causing institutions to shift to a more tuition-based business model. In part because of that, both the what I have called the credentialization of higher education in my research, so the proliferation of more degrees and the requirement that people obtain more degrees to get a certain job or certain income in the labor market, as well as changing financial aid policies. So there's always been a degree of price discrimination in higher education. That is, you have a sort of financial aid package that's in theory tailored to your ability to pay. And the idea historically has been that that financial aid should be egalitarian. So people from better off backgrounds pay higher tuition for university. What's happened is that the price discrimination has shifted subtly towards the less egalitarian motivation. So that means rather than people who can pay paying more, it's people with fewer options paying more. And that is what this what institutions can get away with charging students in particular. And people who have fewer options tend to be people from poorer backgrounds. And I should say all of this is in light of a vastly expanding student population. So it used to be that one of the reasons higher education was considered an egalitarian is because many people from poorer or working class backgrounds just didn't have any contact with the higher education system. That's gone away as it's basically become impossible to get much other than a minimum wage job without at least some college or some higher education credential. So overall, the student population in the entire United States is expanding as for younger cohorts, but what we're seeing is lack of access to the state flagship institutions that have historically been the most successful at social promotion, at social mobility, and thus most live out the idea of egalitarian higher education.
Thank you, Marshall. Finally, let's turn to Dr. Lori Kovaleski-Jones, professor and chair of the Department of Family and Consumer Studies. Go ahead, Lori.
So at this point of the program, we might be thinking to ourselves, what can we do? What are some programs, interventions that could be helpful? And I'd like to talk to you today about an intervention that we have been working on together with the College of Social and Behavioral Sciences, Health Sciences here on campus, and community partners. And it centers around the Earned Income Tax Credit. The Earned Income Tax Credit, as many of you in the audience might know, is probably the United States' best social idea to propel families away from poverty and towards the middle class. It has bipartisan support. On the one hand, it is a social safety net program. On the other, it only works when a person works. And how it works is a person makes a dollar and the federal government matches a percentage of that to an income threshold and then it fades away. And this has been such an important program. But what's the issue? The issue is there are a whole lot of people who are eligible who are not using the program. Nationally, it's a 20% non-participation rate, which means 5.8 million households and $7.3 billion that is being left on the table. In Utah, the issue is a little bit worse. It's 25% of a non-participation rate. This means about 57,000 households, of which 30,000 households have our families with children, are missing out on $66.4 million that is not coming from the federal government. It's not coming into the state of Utah where it could have important spillover effects, and it's not getting into the households of families that could really benefit from it. So when we think about this consistent proportion of 25% of households who don't get the EITC, let's contextualize this a little bit. I'd like to tell you about a woman we like to talk about in our group, Maria. She has two kids, she works two jobs, she makes $30,000. So at $30,000, she's entitled to an EITC benefit of $3,500. Also, when you file taxes, you are eligible for the child tax credit as well. That's an extra $2,800. So Maria could take her income from $30,000 to $36,300. That's a 21% increase in her income. And if you think about that on a monthly basis, it's significant influx of resources. So what's the issue? The issue, remember, Maria, she works two jobs, so she's probably busy. And Maria, like a lot of other folks, she may have a less than perfect impression of what the federal government could actually do for her. So what we want to do in our program is to increase awareness about the EITC by providing education about how to get it and providing access points where families already go with people they can trust. So this is our program. It's called Connect Collect, and it's been a collaboration with, as I said, our college, university health, and key community partners. What we are trying to do is to use data science to hotspot eligible EITC households and then find trusted places. So what are two trusted places that even the really busy families go to? They go to the doctor and they take their kids to school, and they trust the people that they talk to there. And so what we're trying to do is to use a network of bright students and trusted partners to provide free tax assistance help and connecting families to VITA. FIDA is the Volunteer Income Tax Assistance Program. It's fabulous. But one of the problems is that a lot of times families who are eligible for the EITC are just as likely to pick for-profit tax preparers that can take a lot of their income or their return. So what we want to do is change that. We want to connect families to VIDA. In the short term, it's going to increase family income. It's also going to have important state benefits in terms of the spillover of dollars that come into our state economy. And then over the lifespan, there is just such a durable connection between receiving the EITC and health and wealth across the lifespan.
Thank you, Lori. Why does income inequality really matter? I mean, it's one thing to say that we have the same level of inequality as Cameroon, but we're not really in the same situation. When you look at the US, we have one of the world's highest GDPs per capita, one of the world's top median incomes. If we're doing so well economically with high incomes, a high standard of living, why should we care that some people are making far more than others? Norman, do you want to start off on that one?
I think profoundly, we believe that one of the pillars of the American dream, if you will, that we have one, that basically people can start out at a rung, and through their hard work and through basically talent and hard work, that they can make it into sort of a better outcome than their parents. This has been shown over the last 30 years to be grossly diminished with rising inequality in the United States. Social mobility, as documented by many studies, has gone down, and that's true for Utah as well. So as we impinge upon that American dream that children are not doing as well as their parents or can't make it, we do see those deaths of despair rise. We do see basically the stresses associated with the absence of social mobility impinging upon our society, and the polarization is occurring both politically and reconstituting our institutions in a way that make for some difficulties in even addressing these problems in terms of the reduction of the public sphere and the financialization of the economy. There are so many dimensions here. I just want to touch on the major, touched on the major issue, I think, that's of concern to people. Why do you care what your neighbor makes? We really don't. But when the overall society, the fabric, is being tethered the way it is, so that it's affecting the mobility of its citizens, then we do care.
In sociology and sociology of health, they talk about absolute deprivation and relative deprivation, and both of those things having negative impacts on people's health. And when we think about absolute deprivation, it's like you don't have access to clean water, you don't have a safe place to sleep. And then when we think about relative deprivation, I think that gets at the question, is this sense that we have when we know that other people have more than us, when we're striving to get what other people have. And sometimes we're doing that because we already have enough, and sometimes we're doing that because we actually don't have enough. But that stress of relative deprivation and comparisons and living in a society that's so divided and so unequal, as Norm was saying, it causes stress, it causes health effects. And so as we think about why inequality matters, I think it matters both in terms of the absolutes and also in terms of these relative comparisons.
Dr. Mendoza, you talked about some of the big differences in terms of along ethnic lines in our area in terms of our health outcomes. Can you talk about why that might be happening? What, go into some more detail about what are some of the underlying drivers of that disparity along income and ethnic lines?
When we consider where can people of lower income live? And it's generally in places that are less desirable, locations near freeways, locations near large industrial facilities. So these kind of factors, when they combine, you're able to really see zip codes when they're broken up by racial and income lines, the minority communities and the pollution, they go in lockstep. So there are many health outcomes that we've begun to explore. We're all very familiar with what we call established health associations, for example, cancer, cardiovascular, pulmonary associations, but they're lesser known and we call them emerging health associations, such as the impact of environmental exposure on mental health. We've started to see studies affecting, for example, depression, suicide rates, health, educational outcomes. All of these, when they combine, they just multiply. And as Dr. Steinbaum also showed, having impacts on health, having impacts on education, they can be very long term and they can actually perpetuate over generations. So this is something that we really need to consider when we're talking about economic disparities and associated outcomes.
Daniel, can you address the situation with the coronavirus in particular? What are your thoughts there on terms of what's driving the different outcomes?
Mm-hmm. I think that it's primarily really the fact that lower income populations tend to have jobs that are considered essential, that are that these people do have to show up. This population has to show up to really provide the benefits of our life that we enjoy, such as if you want to get your hair cut, I know that that's been a point of contention across social media. I must get my hair cut. Well, someone is going to cut your hair, and it's generally lower income population have to do that. It's also access to health. Can you afford, if you're lower income and you're paid by the hour and you have to be there at your job, can you afford to not only pay for the hospital visit or the clinic visit, but also afford to not go those hours to your job? And really the luxury of taking time off to go to work that many of us take for granted. I mean, we just rearrange our schedule and say, well, you know what? Our dentists can only see us on Thursday from 11 to noon. Well, we just cancel all our meetings, but not everyone can afford to do that. Same with healthcare and same with really choosing what kind of career you can have. So that I think that those are really some of the main drivers that are causing some of those disparities.
Peter, I wonder if I can make a short point. So the nature of relative deprivation today is very different. We live in a very distinctive era, quite frankly. People don't even know that they're relatively deprived to some extent because the upper reaches of the income are invisible in many respects. People have no idea what the nature is of the top income brackets that are basically winning such a high proportion of the income. It really is not even just the top 1%, but the top 10th and the top 100th and 1,000th of 1%. A top 500 or 1,000 families in the country winning a grossly disproportionate amount of the income. This is invisible to most people in the United States, but it's having a profound effect, not directly on a feeling of relative deprivation, but a feeling of a sense that they basically, institutions have changed in a way, the game has been rigged in a new way that basically stresses them out because they're putting in the effort and they're not getting the returns.
What are the steps that you talk and take as a state and maybe our local communities to ensure that immigrants and their children don't disappear into a low-income trap? I mean, is there a social mobility toolkit that we can put together? And if so, what would that look like?
Immigration is historically one of the main engines of social mobility. International immigration is an engine of social mobility. And in particular, immigrants to the United States achieve high degrees of social mobility between the immigrants themselves and their children, even in just one generation. And that has been true across basically every wave of immigration that's happened in U.S. history. So that was true in the waves that happened in the 19th century up through the early 20th century. And it's true now. There's surprisingly little difference across in that phenomenon over time. However, there are definitely things that can impede social mobility of immigrants, occupational segregation being a big one. And I think that plays into the environmental segregation and the expendable workforce that Professor Mendoza was previously mentioning. That says, you know, certain jobs are allocated to immigrants and we will choose to make those jobs not consistent with living a healthy lifestyle. And you can see that in the ways that jobs get deprofessionalized. past. So jobs that had previously been done not by an immigrant population, like one mechanism by which they can be made to be paid less and to have less secure employment and lower health and occupational safety is by making the workforce essentially more exploitable. And I think, you know, this is one thing I think it's important to understand. You know, the United States has had a lot of immigration in the last couple of decades, but I don't think it's correct to characterize that immigration as an open borders policy. I prefer to refer to it as a high walls policy, meaning that, you know, what had been previously a seasonal flow of people looking for work and not being resident is made by and both a sort of excessive border enforcement regime and also enforcement against resident immigrants in the United States. It's made such that you basically can't leave and come back. And so that is what gives rise to a population of workers that can be kind of exploited and has little chance of ever achieving status, either for themselves or in some cases, especially for their children. You know, so this just basically pits workers together. It's not the fact of being an immigrant against each other. It's not a fact of being an immigrant that causes a race to the bottom, but the fact that we have put immigrants in a particular position to be exploited as a way of undermining the status of all workers in this economy.
Dr. Kowalewski, let's talk about data. How can we better use data to track and reduce inequality in Utah?
Thanks for that question. We have a real opportunity, and we also have some really great resources here in our college, Nexus and the Associated Wasatch Front Data Research Center. I think that we have some real opportunities to bring partnerships to be, you know, the One Utah for Utah with health sciences and with community partnerships, and to provide spatial data, much like that could be generated about neighborhoods, neighborhood inequality. We're going to be using hotspotting data to better identify the EITC families that we want to track and to contact. So I think it's exciting to think about partnerships going forward to come together on these issues, because if you can see it, you can do something about it.
One of the questions was, I think, in response to Norm's comment about the tippy-tippy top of the top, why don't we just tax them a lot more?
Yeah. Marsha, you want to chime in?
Progressive taxation. Yes, I think there's basically nothing more important than that. It's a little hard to implement as a state-only policy, as we've seen. I mean, states can implement effective progressive tax policies, and they can certainly implement harmful regressive tax policies, as has happened in Utah in the past. So I would definitely say that's bad. In terms of using tax policy to correct the type of tail inequality that Norm was referring to in his talk, you know, that basically has to be done at the federal level, but there's no reason that it can't be. I think there's a sense in federal policy that taxing the rich is basically sort of impossible because they'll just move it to the Cayman Islands or something, and that's just not true. I think what's happened is a lack of political will at the federal level to tax, and not some sort of impossibility that didn't exist in a previous, like, pre-globalization regime.
I would mention that the nature of change in our tax structure, our state tax structure, while not the critical facet, has been towards a more flat, regressive tax structure over the last 15 years in Utah, which I think is part and parcel of the overall change across the nation.
Yeah, I think that's correct. I mean, people have pointed to overall reduction in tax loads and in the quote, size of government. And I think that's actually really an incorrect interpretation of what's gone on in the sort of budget and tax side. There's been a strong reduction in progressive tax rates, so effective tax rates on higher earning people. I think that is basically the reason why you see the rise in tail inequality. But there has been an increase in the effective tax rates, especially when you take into account the criminal justice system and the so-called fines and fees that are extremely regressive in their incidence, and as basically alternative means of financing municipal and state budgets. So we have not seen an overall reduction in the in which the population is taxed. It's just a strong redistribution, a regressive redistribution in who has to pay the taxes.
There seems to be a geographic and spatial element that we're contending with here. Could you all comment, and I guess just go down the line, if there was a thing that you each would like to see that we could be doing better to connect people with opportunities, what would that policy approach be?
I'll start. I think we have a real opportunity when we connect between the U and the community and have that dialogue. I think that forums like this are really helpful to start the story, but they have to kind of continue, I guess, on Zoom for now, but with community partners and with different parts of our university, because together that's how we're going to reach out and identify problems and begin to address them.
I think that one of the main problems, and this is a personal problem that I saw when I came here to Salt Lake City, was when I found out about air quality events, and they all were, none of those events were staged west of State Street. And we can't just expect everyone to come to us for knowledge. We need to go in towards the community, first of all, to places where people are comfortable attending, to places where people are already visiting, and also make sure it's accessible to everyone. A very simple thing to do is simply make sure that at least have multiple languages for some of the materials and information for air quality.
I mean, I thought when I came to Utah back over a little over 30 years ago, I heard that basically there was a very concerted effort in the high schools. I think South High closed, and then the redistricting to West, East, and Highland was done in a profound way to address some of the socioeconomic disparities by residents. And so it equalized some of the exposure of students to each other from different backgrounds. And in the high school, it's really a lovely thing, but I think that too often now we become segregated. Of course, the residential component that both Sarah and Daniel have been talking about is very important in terms of exposures to pollution, but the schooling at the elementary level is still rather segregated. People move to opportunity, and the people who have the opportunities move. So it's become a very difficult situation. There's a distinct residential or aerial component. It's profound.
Yeah, what I was going to add was just that as the research continues to mount that, you know, children, for example, are affected in utero by air pollution exposures. And as was just said, people are moving to opportunity, people that are able to move, but many people are not able to move. And so I think fundamentally, we need more policies that protect low-income and racial ethnic minority children so they don't start off behind and then have to spend their whole life trying to catch up. So if we know that there are these developmental and, you know, brain functioning effects of exposure to air pollution when you're in utero, when you're an infant, like we could possibly legislate the stopping people from moving other places, but that's not so practical. So I think we have to reduce the level of air pollution, reduce the level of exposures so that people aren't starting off with this being behind in terms of their ability to, you know, succeed.
This has been Utah Thrives, the Utah Foundation podcast. Follow our work at utahfoundation.org.